Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the story of nature's most remarkable building material, bones. We'll spend this hour with orthopedic surgeon Roy Meals, who after 40 years in practice is still astonished by the things bones can do. We'll talk about how bones grow, heal themselves after a break, and produce blood cells. We'll hear about some of the ways humans have repurposed bone to make tools, musical instruments, and sacred objects. And we'll talk about why so many people believe the human body contains exactly 206 bones, when the actual total varies depending on who's counting and when. Our conversation starts after a short break. Imagine a building material that is light, strong, and resistant to breakage, but capable of mending any cracks or breaks that do show up. But we're not done yet. Imagine that as you needed more space over time, that same material could stretch and grow without any kind of major renovation necessary. Imperceptibly just a little bigger every day over the course of, say, 15 or 20 years. Nobel Prize territory, right? Well, as it turns out, this material is already available to every one of us, but it's not in our buildings, it's in our bodies. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm talking, of course, about bones. They grow and develop over time just as we need them. And we haven't even mentioned the fact that marrow within them produces our blood cells. Dr. Roy Meals is clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA. And even after decades of practicing and teaching medicine, he is no less astonished by the properties of bone than he was at the very beginning of his career. So he's written a book for us non-physicians to help us all understand what valuable assets we have under the skin. That book is called Bones Inside and Out. Roy, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
I want to start with a little multiple choice test. The question is, the human body has 206 bones. The answer is A, true, B, false, C, possibly, but not necessarily, and it depends on when you're counting.
C.
Tell us about that.
Well, the textbook answer is 206, but that's in adults, and that's kind of an average. I mean, for instance, when we're born, we have about 370 bones, and most of those extra ones are in our skull and allow for the great flexibility of the skull as it passes through the birth canal. And then we all know that the very top of our head is soft in infancy, and then a lot of those bones fuse together. So in the adult version, there are far fewer bones in the skull than in children. But even in adults, that 206 is really nuanced because, for example, it depends on who's looking. If an anthropologist or a paleontologist is sifting the dust off of old bones, it's very unlikely that they're going to find the very small middle ear bones, which are hardly larger than an apple seed, for instance. And those tiny bones are counted. But then there are also other bones that are five or eight times that size, perhaps the size of blueberries, that aren't counted. There's one behind the knee, for instance, that even has a nice name, but that it is not included in that 206. And then most of us have 12 sets of ribs, but occasionally people have 13 sets or 14 sets, but those people with the extra sets, they don't get extra credit for for those bones. And then, for instance, there's a small bone in the wrist called the pisiform, which means P-shaped, and it is counted. And the kneecap is the same sort of bone. It's buried in a tendon, and it is counted. So a radiologist or an orthopedic surgeon who needs to know about these in terms of diagnosis and treatment is that they have a sense of flexibility in terms of finding one of these small bones one day and not the next day. But that's what keeps anatomy interesting and keeps orthopedic surgery interesting, is the individual variability.
So bones are built out of one part collagen, two parts calcium phosphorus crystals. What property does that chemical structure give them?
Well, it's a composite structure, and that's the beginning of why bone is the world's best building material. And I guess you could think of it like plaster on lath, that the collagen is a meshwork of very fine protein long chain molecules that when stretched out there are incredibly strong. They're actually stronger than steel, and that they give the bone some resiliency. And then on this meshwork of the collagen fibers is deposited a particular calcium crystal that makes it hard. So that would be like putting plaster on lath. And so the final composite structure has a little bit of give and flexibility, but that it's relatively hard and compression resistant. And so that therefore it resists gravity and lets us get off the ground. Dissimilar to a sponge or a jellyfish.
A lot of our bones seem to be long and hollow like cylinders. What are the benefits of that particular shape?
Well, that's another one of the remarkable aspects of it. You know, in addition to this composite composition, is that the structure of it is mechanically very sound. We think about an I-beam that you'll see in a bridge. That's designed to be lightweight, and it resists bend in one direction. And basically, the contractor will put an I-beam in so that it resists resists gravity and bending against gravity. But that our bones have to resist bending forces from all directions, and mechanically the most sound construct to do that is a cylinder. And so it's not any surprise that once you understand that that's why bicycle frames have cylindrical tubes, why ski poles are cylindrical, because they can resist bending from all directions. And that is how our bones work. It's a marvelous adaptation, and far better than an I-beam. And then the center of the bone doesn't really add much resistance to bending forces. And so, therefore, the center of the bone is fairly hollow. It's entirely hollow in most bones and birds, for instance, because they appreciate the lightweight in terms of being able to fly. But that hollow, spongy interior doesn't contribute much to the force, and so it's just efficient to have that hollow. And then, of course, in that marrow, we make blood cells, and it's a blood factory.
Yeah, how do blood cells get into and out of the marrow through the bone?
Well, you can imagine that any sizable hole in this cylinder would be a weak spot. And so that in order to avoid such that with normal sized blood vessels, let's say an eighth or even a quarter of an inch in diameter, is that if a hole was big enough to accept that size of blood vessel, is that the bone would be weak there, and you twist it or bump it, it could easily break. And so rather blood gets inside the bone by a very obliquely angled, very small hole. And there are a number of these, what we call nutrient openings in the bone along its shaft. And so that these holes are, no bigger than a pin. You'd have trouble getting a sewing needle or a pin through one of them. But through these multiple obliquely oriented passages is that the blood vessels do enter the marrow, and particularly towards the end of the bone, where there's more marrow and less of the hard surface bone, is that there are more of these nutrient openings.
Do bones without a lot of those nutrient openings have a harder time healing if they've been broken?
Oh, absolutely. There are several areas in the body where the end of the bone is entirely covered with the cartilage, and so there can't be any nutrient openings there. And so the bone under that area that's entirely covered with the cartilage has to receive its blood supply indirectly from further distant inside the bone. So let's say a nutrient vessel enters the bone at mid-shaft, and then it has to pass on the interior bone up under that cartilage covered surface. And so that if the bone breaks adjacent to that cartilage covered surface, is that then blood vessels can only come from that one direction to heal the bone. Whereas in a well-vascularized bone and mid-shaft, where the blood vessels can come from both directions to bring nutrients. And so the places that orthopedists worry about having these bones break adjacent to a cartilage surface, there's one in the ankle, the head of the thigh bone, the ball on the thigh bone is the same way, and there's a small bone in the wrist that's notorious for being slow to heal because of this issue of blood vessels versus needing to have the end of the bone covered with cartilage.
So if a bone has broken but is set properly, by what process does it heal itself? How does that bone sort of know to replace and fill in the spot where the bone's been broken?
Well, I'm smiling right now because that's one of the very exciting things about the bone. If we cut our skin, or if somebody has an injury to their liver or brain, those tissues heal with scar tissue, which is basically just a dense, thick network of collagen fibers. And if you feel a skin scar, it's maybe a little bit raised. It's not quite as soft as the adjacent skin, and it probably doesn't have as good of a sensation as your adjacent healthy skin. And that's the way nearly every tissue in the body heals. The exception is a bone. It actually heals with bone. And what happens is that immediately after the fracture is that blood leaks out of the capillaries, and then bone cells creep into this blood clot. They begin to make the meshwork of the protein collagen fibers. And then on this meshwork, the bone cells secrete the calcium crystals that begin to make new bone. And then the really remarkable thing is that the bone remodels. So initially, if you looked at a fracture that was a week old, you'd see this almost kind of what you'd call it, a wad of immature new bone around the fracture site. The calcium crystalline bone has a physical property that when it is compressed is that it generates a very small electrical force. And that's, for the technocrats, that's called a piezoelectric. It has a piezoelectric property so that it generates a very small electrical force. And so that when you walk on your bone, is that these small electrical forces are generated, and then the bone forming cells and the bone remodeling cells follow those electrical forces. And because if the bone's generating electrical forces, it means that the bone needs help in that area. And so by this means, the fractured area that's initially covered with this wad of immature bone is that over a year or two, it remodels. And remarkably, it might take 6 months or a year in a child's thigh fracture, and it might take 3 or 4 years in an adult thigh fracture, but that the bone remodels to the point that you could take an x-ray of both thighs and not be able to tell which bone had the fracture. And so that's truly remarkable. You know, if we cut our skin, there's always evidence of the skin being cut because of the scar. But because bone heals with bone and it remodels, it is truly a remarkable substance. You know, a bridge can't do that. Trees can't do that. Our other tissues can't do that. A bone is unique in that respect.
My guest is Dr. Roy Meals. He is clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA and author of the new book, Bones, Inside and Out. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Roy Meals, clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA and author of the book Bones, Inside and Out. Of course, Roy, there are lots of animals in the world that get along just fine without any bones inside their bodies. What do bones have to do with how large a creature can get?
Well, there are certainly other successful skeletal systems in the world. I mean, think about clams and snails. They have what we call an exoskeleton, but their skeleton is their shell on the outside of their body. And those shells are made out of calcium. It's a slightly different crystal than the calcium crystal that we have in bone. But that clearly, that's been a very successful skeletal support system, and that the animal in the shell can keep adding more calcium crystals to the edge of the shell to make it larger. And so, as they grow, their home can grow. The problem that I have with a shell calcium exoskeleton is that it's very heavy, and that it suits them fine on the seafloor or a snail crawling across my plants, but that you would never expect a shelled animal to run or even fly. And I think there are instances in the sea where calcium shells have grown to be as large as 600 pounds, but that's obviously not very common. And then the other very successful exterior skeletal support system is the one that's used by spiders and insects and lobsters. And that is a shell made of a different protein called chitin. And that provides a thin, waterproof covering for the animal, but it doesn't grow as the animal grows. And so that if a crab wants to grow larger, it has to temporarily crawl out of that old shell. Same with an insect. The process is called molting, and then be very vulnerable to predators. So while a new hard and larger chitin shell is developing. So for these reasons, and that's lightweight, and so we know that beetles can fly, for instance, and so that's been a very successful skeletal support system. But that when we compare either one of those to a bone, which, as you noted in the introduction, does continue to grow with us for 15 or 20 years, it's not particularly heavy but with respect to our overall body weight, and that we don't have to crawl out of it to have a new one. So that, and the fact that it heals itself. So all of those properties lead me to the conclusion that it is the world's best building material.
How does bone grafting work?
Bone grafting. The cells, if we just look at if I just say bone to somebody, and I think maybe the visual image that comes up is a skull drying on the hot plains of West Texas, for instance. But that, in fact, bone is alive. We've talked about the blood vessels that it gets, and that we don't see it very often. And I think most of us have the wish that we never get to see our own bone. And so that, it's a little bit unknown, but that bone is alive and the cells do need nourishment, but that it is possible surgically to take a section of bone from one area of the body and then move it to another area and have those bone cells survive and continue to make a bone. So, for instance, that's used often in fusions of the cervical spine or the lumbar spine, where not only will internal fixation in terms of screws and short rods be placed, but that then the surgeon will pack that area with bone graft typically taken out of the rim of the hip to accelerate the bone growth. Basically, the surgeon is adding cells, bone cells, to the area just to stimulate the fusion mass.
And scientists have now come up with materials that can be used to sort of fix bone while it's, or stabilizing it while it's being repaired. And then those materials dissolve. Explain how that works.
Well, that's an amazing history of internal fixation of fractures, and that it really got started in about 1880s, and people were putting brass or iron plates and screws in, and that they would stabilize the fracture, but that they were not resistant to the salty nature of the body's internal chemistry, and so that they would essentially rust, and they'd cause a reaction, and they might rust and become rusted away before the fracture had healed. And then stainless steel was a game changer in the early 1900s, because this metal was non-reactive to the body's salty environment, and so that for oh, nearly 100 years. So we've been using stainless steel quite successfully. And then in more recent decades, in the last several decades, is that we also use titanium, because it is a little bit lighter than stainless steel. The problem with these non-reactive metal implants is that they actually protect the bone from generating those piezoelectric activities. And so let's say we have a fracture of our thigh bone and put a long plate and screws on it. Yes, it stabilizes the fracture, but then as the person begins to walk on it, it is that the weight-bearing forces are not transmitted through the bone, but they're transmitted, from the foot up to the hip through the plate. And so those calcium crystals at the fracture site, they act like couch potatoes, and they don't realize that they should be working hard to make the bone solid and strong. And so we call that stress shielding. And then that's not the only issue, but that oftentimes the plate and screws are bulky. They may be palpable under the skin. That's particularly prominent on the little finger side of the forearm. If you break that bone there and have plate and screws, as it usually, once it healed, the patient can actually run their finger along that border of their forearm and feel the screw heads and count how many screws there were. And so that's annoying when they rest their forearm on a edge of a table or a desk. And so oftentimes, and more often in the lower limb than in the upper limb, is that a year or two after the fracture is healed, is that that plate and screws has to be removed. And so that relieves the problem of stress shielding. But that poses another problem, because those screw holes where the screws come out, is that they are weak, and that the patient has to be careful for about 6 or 8 weeks after the hardware is removed, so that they don't have a pathological fracture through a screw hole. So these problems of stress shielding and the need for hardware removal would be eliminated if, in fact, we had the plates and screws made out of a material that would dissolve by itself. And so let's say it's nice and solid for 4 months, and that's long enough to protect the fracture and have it heal. And then it slowly dissolves. And so slowly the loads are transferred from the plate to the bone itself. And so those bone cells can get to work and remodel the bone, and then eventually the plate and screws just dissolve completely.
Wow.
And there's been a lot of work on that, and we're getting closer. But that I would think that probably within 5 to 15 years, so we'll have more of those really high tech manufactured materials that will provide these benefits. It's an exciting future in that regard.
We have Janice calling us from Grapevine, Texas. Hi, Janice.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, I have a question about joint replacement and
Sure.
their relationship to the connecting bones. I've had two knee replacements and a hip replacement, and I'm wondering what effect those joint replacements are having on the surrounding bones, connecting bones.
Thanks for calling.
That's a great question, and one of the major hurdles that had to be overcome in terms of making a successful joint replacement was the interface between the replacement and the adjacent bone. So, with an arthritic joint, the arthritic joint surfaces are cut away, and then in a knee, for instance, there will be a stem that goes down inside the bone on one side, and then it has an artificial metal joint surface on it. And then on the other surface, there will be a metal-backed implant that has a polyethylene surface on it. So it's a very low friction combination that allows for the joint to glide smoothly. But that the bone adjacent to these implants does undergo some stress shielding, and that there are instances where that makes the bone weak, might cause the implant to loosen, so that even though total hips have been around since the early 1960s and total knees maybe 10 years less, is that there is continued design innovations going into them to make them more durable and to allow the adjacent bone to be shielded less in terms of making the implant hopefully life durable.
How do you learn to install a new kind of implant? Do you go to some kind of training program? Is there a video sent to you? Do you just get the package and obviously you're not just figuring it out on your first patient, but explain the learning curve.
Well, there's all sorts of continuing education opportunities, and I think orthopedic surgeons are, I don't know, I think we're rather curious. Most of us got into orthopedics because we enjoyed working with tools and either, you know, building or repairing furniture or building musical instruments or repairing cars. And so we grew up in a tool culture. And then our national meetings are full of instructional programs where the expert, perhaps the innovator of a new design, will present instructional courses. The companies that manufacture the implants, they have a vested interest in A, you're using the implant, and B, you're using it properly so that it develops a good reputation. And so their technical reps are versed in that they have spoken at length with the developer of the implant, and so that they are a good source of information as well. And then there are also YouTube videos and instructions manuals and so forth. And I mean, for instance, the man who really invented total hip replacement, his name was John Charnley in England. And once he worked out the details of this, is that the world really beat a path to his door to learn this technique, but that he insisted that everybody that came to his center to learn this technique, that they stay 2.5 days, and that they actually pass a little test when they finish before that he would give them the set of instruments to take home and do it on his own. And so that he made sure that there was quality control there, and that people just wouldn't willy-nilly start using his implant and using it improperly and then having bad results with it, and then smearing the entire reputation of the implant. And he really worked hard on this, and he got, this is a fun story, that he got started in this because a patient with a substandard total hip implant said that every time he leaned forward at the dinner table, his hip implant would squeak, which greatly annoyed his wife and disturbed her to the point that she would have to get up and leave the dinner table. So then he set off on a quest to find the right materials to make a low friction total hip implant that wouldn't squeak. And so in the process of really very carefully designing this implant and having the quality control in terms of having people come to his center to learn it, is that appropriately so, he became knighted, and everybody in orthopedics knows him as Sir John.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have James on the line in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hello. Thank you, Chris, and great show. I'm very curious. I have had a gum recession, and my dentist always says it's because of lost bone around my teeth, not enough bone holding the teeth. And the dentist has told me that this bone generally doesn't grow back. And but I'm, based on what you were saying about bone healing and the piezoelectric effects, et cetera, I'm wondering why the bone that holds the teeth would not grow back.
I think, James, this is a question, is the bottle half full or half empty? The fact that for most of us in most of our situations that it does regenerate itself and maintain its strength is a marvel. And it's clear that, you know, as we get older and osteoporosis sets in and so forth, is that we do have some problems with it. And so, not being a dentist or an oral surgeon, I can't give you a very specific answer at this, but that I think that maybe we should say that when life gives us lemons, think lemonade and appreciate that not all of our teeth are having a bone recession about it. And, you know, I think part of it too is just the way that the forces are applied to the bone. And you can imagine if you have a fracture of the middle of your thigh bone, is that every time you walk on it, you're applying these compressive forces that stimulate new bone growth. But for instance, when we chew, is that we're putting compressive forces on our teeth, but we're not putting side to side forces on them like we might do if we were twisting or turning a corner when we were walking.
Is there anything we can do to keep astronauts from losing so much bone because they're not able to do weight-bearing exercise in space?
Well, that's a serious question now with people spending 3 to 6 months on the space station, but it's going to be a huge problem when we begin sending people to Mars, and that'll be a 2-year round trip, and that the degree of osteoporosis that they get then may mean that they have to be very, very careful when they get home, and it's possible that even sneezing could break rib bones that are that that fragile. And so, of course, there are these medications that particularly postmenopausal women take now to minimize loss of bone and minimize the risk of fragility of fractures, and that I think some of the astronauts are taking these bones now. And to my knowledge, is that presently all of the space station visitors are either premenopausal or not prone to menopause.
All right, but let me jump in for a break here. My guest is okay. Dr. Roy Meals, clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA, author of Bones Inside and Out. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Roy Meals, clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA and author of the new book, Bones, Inside and Out. Roy, before the break, you were telling us that astronauts may be given drugs that are supposed to fight osteoporosis so that they don't lose too much bone while they're up in space for extended periods of time. We had to stop for a break, and I wanted to make sure that there wasn't anything else you needed to say about that.
Well, two interesting things. One is that they have treadmills in the space station, but that in a zero gravity situation, that as soon as you take a step on the treadmill is that you float off the treadmill. So the only way that will work is with bungee cords attached to a harness on your waist or shoulders that keep you attached to the treadmill. The other interesting avenue of research that's going on is that bears will hibernate for 4 or 5 months and be entirely indolent during that time. And for reasons we don't understand presently, is that they do not get disuse osteoporosis. And so there are very adventuresome investigators that will crawl into a bear cave in the wintertime, sedate the bear, and then draw blood and creep out and take the blood back to the lab and analyze it for the factors that hopefully will identify the way the bears keep from becoming osteoporotic, and then develop this type of treatment for astronauts and maybe even for older adults on Earth.
Wow. So human cultures for a very long time have obviously been fascinated by the way bones last long after the rest of a body has decomposed. Can you talk about some of the uses people have made of human and animal bones over time?
Well, it's really a testimony to the innovative capacities of humans, but that in times gone past, particularly in Siberia and Ukraine, is that mammoth bones were used as a framework for winter structures. They'd build a big dome, maybe 20 feet in diameter, with these bones, and then cover them with hides as protection. And then particularly in Inuit cultures where they didn't have wood and traditionally did not have plastic or metal, is it pretty much anything that they needed that was hard was made out of bone. And so these were spear points and sewing needles, snow knives, harnesses, toggle harnesses for their dog sleds. They would cover the, they would surface the running surface on their sled rails with bone to make them glide smoother over the ice across the Midwest. Native Americans have, of course, used a bone for arrow points, but that also for cooking utensils and jewelry, adornments of all sorts. It's an amazing material. It's reasonably easy to work, and it's incredibly durable, and that it's also beautiful. Its white hard surface is a joy to look at.
There were certain bones that were like the perfect shape for tent pegs. Is that right, for Inuit peoples?
Oh, yes. The used them for everything. I just really enjoy going to anthropology museums and just continually amazed at the creativity that they use to meet their daily needs.
When did museums first start displaying dinosaur bones?
Well, that goes back to the 1850s, and that there was a natural scientist then who was in Philadelphia, and that he assembled the first dinosaur skeleton at the Natural History Museum there, and that it was wildly popular, that the museum stayed open for extra hours, and that they had to hire extra crews to clean and maintain the museum because of this attraction to the public that wanted to see this skeleton. And then prior to that is that these fossilized dinosaur bones had just rested in a dusty drawer or shelf in the back of the museum and of interest to the scientific specialists, but did not of interest to the lay public. And so this kindled the interest in the dinosaurs, and that it's impossible to go to a natural history museum these days and probably be met even in the lobby by a Tyrannosaurus Rex ready to gobble up everybody. And that so that this has allowed dinosaurs to capture the imagination of everybody.
Is there anything you notice as an orthopedic surgeon that maybe the average visitor wouldn't, looking at those either models or actual bones?
Yes. Once you get used to it, I mean, Sue, for instance, is the Tyrannosaurus Rex that was in the atrium of the Field Museum in Chicago for many years, but that she lived a tough life, and that she has rib fractures that were sustained during life because they now have a wad of new bone around them. So she took some hard tumbles. She apparently had an infection in her jaw. She had arthritis in her spine. And that she also had a wishbone. Some dinosaurs, like some birds, have wishbones. And so I don't think the average visitor would look beyond the ferocious teeth and the gigantic size of T-Rex and not see these subtleties. But that's what keeps it fun for me, is that I learn something new every day, and I love going to museums. I mean, you mentioned musical instruments and stuff. One of my most amazing visits was to the Musical Instrument Museum in Phoenix. I went just to have a nice afternoon looking at musical instruments, but lo and behold, there were all sorts of bone flutes in there. A lot of the fittings for bagpipes are made out of bone. apropos to Texas, there was a ukulele where the body of the ukulele was made out of an armadillo shell.
Wow.
Go to fine art museums, maritime museums. I can probably find some bone to excite myself. And I think maybe your listeners now will go with their eyes open and have some unexpected surprises themselves.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Melissa is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Melissa.
Hi there. I wanted to ask about times when the body deconstructs the bone. We talked about how strong the bone is, but I had a disease called Cushing's disease, which is excess cortisol in the body. And among many of the strange constellation of symptoms, weight gain, redness in the face, all those things is osteoporosis. So I've met some patients who had lots of broken bones and osteoporosis, even at very young ages. So could you tell me a little bit about how that happens, how cortisol damages the bone? And the good news is, after I was treated, I don't have osteoporosis anymore.
I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for calling, Melissa.
Glad to hear that. The bone is not only under the mechanical regulation of the piezoelectric forces, but it's also under the hormonal regulation. And that comes from a lot of different endocrine glands, pituitary, thyroid, adrenal glands, ovaries, or testes, and that for the bone health to be perfect, is that these endocrine glands and the hormones that they secrete have to all work in a harmony and in a beautiful concert. And I think the amazing thing is that 99.9% of the time they do. But that if there's an excess of one hormone or an absence of one hormone, well, then the other chemical mediators of bone health cannot necessarily keep up. And so in your instance, yes, that's quite common that people with a hormonal imbalance like this will become osteoporotic.
All right, let's go back to the phones and this time speak with Nikki in Plano. Hi, Nikki.
Yeah, hi. What an intriguing conversation. Thank you. I just had a very insightful information from you regarding electrical impulses and bone, which I was totally unaware of. And I want to know if the gentleman has any viewpoint on how these devices that we carry with us all the time have any impact whatsoever, or does he have an opinion on that, or any research been done on it at all?
Unlike the piezoelectric forces and whether that our cell phones interfere with those, is that what you're asking?
Correct. Cell phones, you know, laptops, I mean, everything's electrical around us.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Good question. I haven't really thought about that before, but that I think that just empirically that, you know, having been around radio waves and television waves and microwaves and telephone waves and stuff, is the fact that our bones aren't falling apart. I think that this is just an entirely different order of magnitude. The piezoelectric forces are very, very local. And I think that electrical waves that are generated by our phones, for instance, are just not significant in that regard. But that's one of the reasons I enjoy talking about bone, is the things that I learned. So I'll think about that some more.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a physician, when would you decide to order an X-ray on a patient as opposed to an MRI or a CT scan?
Well, X-rays, they're going to have their 125th birthday of discovery in about 2 weeks. And so early on, nobody appreciated the danger of X-rays, and that within a few weeks of the discovery of X-rays is that there were photographers on the street that would take a chest X-ray for you or X-ray of your ankle or whatever. And a lot of it was out of curiosity. And then it was over 20 years or so that people realized that these unseen rays were damaging and could cause cancer. And so modern day techniques were, we have a good idea about when it's right to take an X-ray and when it's not. For instance, if you come in with a sore throat, the doctor and you are probably going to know that it's not necessary or reasonable or safe to take an X-ray. But if you come in with a sprained ankle, then that may change the issue. And so I think in a great extent, we're still learning what the right indications for a CT scan or an MRI are, and that sometimes, unfortunately, the knee-jerk reaction is the doctor says, well, I don't know, and so let's get a CT scan or let's get an MRI. Or the patient who maybe is rather proactive, but maybe not totally informed, says, well, aren't you going to get an MRI, doctor? How can you be sure of your diagnosis without getting an MRI? And certainly the CT scans are damaging because they are radiation. They are x-rays that are taken from multiple different angles around the body. The MRI does not involve radiation, but that it has a huge influence on anything magnetic, and they're both expensive. And sometimes they identify variations in the body that aren't pathological, but that sometimes it's better just not to know about these variations, because if the patient or the doctor looks at these variations and say, whoa, look at that, that's not quite normal, I think we ought to biopsy that, and they biopsy it and it gets infected, and then the patient ends up worse off than not. And so that we're getting a better feeling for when an MRI or a CT scan is needed, but that certainly shouldn't be a knee-jerk reaction to expect one or to anticipate that it's truly going to help you.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You note in the book that the calcium content of our bones peaks at age 25 and then keeps diminishing every year thereafter. That's a long time to be losing calcium. How can we keep our bones healthy throughout our lives?
Walk or jog, and that stimulates those piezoelectric forces and keeps the bone in our legs and spine at its maximum health. Running and swimming, for instance, are great for heart and lungs, but they don't generate the necessary compressive forces to stimulate the piezoelectric activity. And so to keep our bones as strong as possible then minimizes the risk of what we call fragility fractures. And one of the major ones is when somebody falls and breaks their hip. And in fact, probably it's not that the patient falls and breaks their hip, but think about this, is that they probably twist, break their weak bone, and then fall. But it all happens so fast that they associate it with a fall and then a broken hip. But that elderly people with broken hips is that only 50% of them will ever recover their pre-injury level of independence. A lot of them have to end up in lifetime rehab facilities. And 20% of people after 20% of old people after a broken hip will die within the first year. And it's not the hip fracture that kills them, but it's the bed rest, the pneumonia, urinary tract infection, general debility. And so I cannot stress too importantly the importance of regular walking or jogging in terms of preventing these potentially lethal conditions.
All right. Dr. Roy Meals is clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA and author of Bones, Inside and Out. Roy, thank you for spending this time with us.
Oh, my pleasure. As you can tell, I enjoy talking about bones, and I hope that everybody else enjoyed listening and will pay additional attention to them.
All right. Thank you. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.